lumped up group, and they created the weighted average, the GDP weighted average. Russia should be weighted the same as Germany.
Okay.
And take the GDP weighted
average. So GDP weighted average. Okay, now the same question about China. Because they do Asia ex-China?
Yeah, that's easy. Then Asia without China, so take China out of Asia, and they have to restrict all of China without Asia, and then China.
Okay. And they still had the other section? It was Central, South America, Oceania,
they all lumped together?
And they're all in, like, about 19%. So just GDP was it.
Okay, so I'm going to start with, have you been reading the news question? You've been talking about Disney all through the semester, right? So what's a big news story out of Disney in the last week? You have no idea what I'm talking about.
Their guy that was going to come see you.
The story was that Tom Staggs, who was second in line to become the CEO, had surprisingly been asked by the board to leave the company, and he resigned. So the big story is there's a vacuum under Bob Iger, and nobody's quite sure what's going to happen next. We talked about corporate governance. We talked about Bob Iger originally wanting to step down in 2014. And then the board of directors went to him and said, "You're so important, you can't leave." And he said, "No." And they tried again. The third time they said it, he said, "You're right, I'm too important, I can't leave." And he delayed his leaving from 2014 to 2017. That, in my view, is why Disney is having the issues that it has now. Let me explain. Any NFL fans? Let me make it more specific. Any Green Bay Packers fans here? Okay. When Brett Favre was the quarterback for the Packers, legendary quarterback, right? Won, what, two Super Bowls, three? One Super Bowl. No, I acted like he won three. Right? But he got to be 37, and there was this young quarterback on the sideline waiting to come on, a guy called Aaron Rodgers. And the Packers, I'm sure, were tempted, saying, "This is a legend, let's sign him for an extra 2 years." But you know why they didn't? Because they signed him for two more years, Aaron Rodgers was leaving. In hindsight, they did the right thing. They let him go in spite of the fact that he was a legend and in spite of the fact that he'd have liked to have stayed on for an extra 2 years. They said, "We have to make sure that the transition happens." You see the connection? When Bob Iger initially said he was going to leave in 2014, there was a whole stack of people behind him kind of lined up saying, as soon as he leaves, I'm going to move up the ladder. When he said he was not leaving, the minute that he said that, the entire chain below Iger emptied out because those people said, hey, I'm not going to wait another 3 years. I'm going to go somewhere else. Disney's entire executive chain got emptied out because Iger decided he was going to stay an extra 3 years. One more thing to factor when you think about corporate governance. Yes, Justin. What? Jay Rasulo, who was the CFO. He got pushed out a year ago. But I'm saying even the people below them that you don't think about who would have moved up the ranks are no longer there. Go and look at all the divisional heads in 2014. Look at how many are still left. Small decisions can have big consequences. Right? So file that away in corporate governance because this is the reason real companies are interesting. Things continue to happen. So while you're looking at your company for your project, remember the game continues. Everything is changing, and don't be surprised to see more information come out about your company. Okay? Yes. Who dislikes Iger so much? I don't think it's a question of dislike. Bob is actually, from what I've heard from, is a nice guy. But if you're an executive, what do you want to do? You want to rise up the ranks. They left because they were ambitious men and women, and they felt that the slot above them, for the same reason Aaron Rodgers would have left, which is he wanted to be a quarterback of an NFL team. He said, I don't want to be a backup quarterback. I want to be a quarterback. Right. Okay? Same thing's true here. You're the divisional head at Disney. You want to be higher up the ranks. And if the top guy doesn't leave, in a sense, it has a ripple effect, right? There are no slots to move up into. So it's almost like when he decided not to leave, other people looked ahead and said, I'm not waiting 3 years at Disney for him to leave and for me to move up the ranks. I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to go to Fox News. I'm going to go to Time Warner, whatever the choices were. You know. Yeah. That's exactly the problem. Don't change your damn mind. Okay? You tell the world that you're going to leave in 2014 and you change your mind, everybody says, no, that's 3 more years. Okay? You know what? It's not the company that pressured him. Who pressured him? The board of directors did. So it's Bob, and could he have said no? Yes. Just like Julius Caesar could have said, I don't want to be king. But no, he wanted to be king. That's possible. Or it would take a board that actually did its job. That's why you have a board of directors, right? Because people are not selfless, you want a board of directors that does what's best for the company. And just like the Green Bay Packers did the right thing, the board of directors for companies, even if you have a great CEO, sometimes have to say, you are great, but it's time to move on. Right? That's exactly the point. It's not Iger's responsibility to make that decision. It's a board, and the board, in a sense, walked away from its responsibility. And you can blame Iger for doing what, but I blame Iger less than the board. Well, you want a board that thinks like shareholders. You want a board that thinks for what's best for the company shareholders, which is what a board's job is supposed to be, right? That's the reason we have a board, right? And if you don't have that feeling about what's best for the shareholders, then you're going to get, what's in it for the board to do the right thing for the company. That's why we need directors who think like shareholders. No, I wouldn't. I don't think I wouldn't be that cynical. I don't know. Why create a soap opera when you don't need one? It could just be that they really like the guy. Let's face it. You go to a board meeting every year for 10 years with a guy in charge. It's the nature of the process, right? After a while, you start thinking, this guy is indispensable. So I think it happens. That's why I said maybe we need term limits for CEOs. There's a reason we have only two two terms that a president can serve, right? It's not always been that way. It came from FDR serving three terms plus, and people said, if you have a president who gets power, you know, strong enough, maybe you can keep getting, you know, the infrastructure, in a sense, starts to work in favor of keeping the, I mean, look at Africa, right? Every country has people who've been in power, what, 36 years, 38 years, 42 years, 44 years, 47 years. Until they die, they don't drop off. I think that's part of the problem, is you need almost an external system that says, okay, time for you to go. Let's get back to what we were talking about last Wednesday. We were talking about the right mix of debt and equity, and I left you with this table for XYZ widget company, but with Disney numbers, right? This looks just like the XYZ widget company. So there's the debt ratio in the first column. In the second column, you have the beta is rising. Somebody remind me why the beta is going up? It's a levered beta. As my debt to equity ratio goes up, my levered beta goes up. As my levered beta goes up, my cost of equity goes up. As I borrow more money, my cost of debt goes up for two reasons. One is, as I borrow more money, my interest expense gets higher, my coverage ratio gets lower, my rating drops, right? So I go from AAA to AA to single A to BBB to BB all the way down to C. What's the other thing that's kicking in after 60%? Is I don't have enough income to cover my interest expenses, so my tax benefits also start to scale down. So my cost of debt becomes higher. My cost of equity goes up, my cost of debt goes up. And that's going to be true for every one of your companies. As you increase debt ratios, both the cost of equity and the cost of debt will go up. But the cost of capital could go down. That sounds almost impossible, right? How can the two ingredients both increase and the cost of capital go down? Initially, because you're replacing more expensive equity with cheaper debt, your cost of capital decreases. In fact, what's the end game here? What's my objective? It's to minimize my cost of capital. And where is it minimized? It's minimized at 40% debt, which gives me a 7.16% cost of capital. The optimal debt ratio for Disney is 40% debt, 60% equity. Any questions? Now, what I'm going to show you in the next page adds absolutely no information, but it looks prettier. What I did was I took the cost of capital and showed it as a graph. So basically, this is the same as the table in a graph. And the reason I want to show you this graph again is in most textbooks, including the ones I learned corporate finance from, the cost of capital always took a U shape. You look at this graph, it's not quite a U, right? Initially, as you borrow money, your cost of capital decreases. But then you get to a point where you hit this inflection point, where all of a sudden it starts rising, not just a little bit, but by a lot. And that is actually what I think is more common than the U-shape, which is the cost of capital will decrease a little bit as you initially borrow money. But there's a point where if you borrow the extra dollar, your cost of capital kind of implodes. Why does that happen? Because as your rating drops off, you get into that vicious circle of people thinking you're in trouble, you get more trouble. So you see this with Valiant right now, which is the company kind of spinning down because people are concerned. And once they get concerned, it spins out of control. The way I read this is if I'm going to make a mistake on capital structure, I want it to be too little debt rather than too much debt. I can live with too little debt as a company because my cost of capital is a little higher than it should be. But if I borrow too much, you can very quickly end up putting your entire company at risk. Any questions? Now, this is the fourth edition of the book that you have or don't have, depending on whether you bought the book or not. I've done Disney in each of the editions, Disney has been a company that's shown up. So I've done this cost of capital graph with each edition. So I'm going to show you what the cost of capital graph looked like in my 1997 edition. That was the first edition of this book. I did the same thing that I did for Disney now. I came up with an optimal debt ratio of about 40%, and I graphed out the cost of capital. Notice, though, the one interesting or different thing about this graph. Initially, as you borrow money, your cost of capital decreases. No surprise there. Your optimal is at 40%, and as you start borrowing beyond 40%, your cost of capital starts to go up when you go to 50 and 60. And then when you go from 60 to 70, there is a second dip. There's a kink in the cost of capital graph. It's a kinky cost of capital graph. This Excel spreadsheet that you're going to get with the email that I'm going to send you today, which is going to, I promised you this last week, but I never sent it to you because there was too many attachments already, and I knew you were going to ignore it anyway. So this week, maybe you won't ignore it. I'm going to send you the optimal capital structure spreadsheet. That spreadsheet in an earlier form, in a much more primitive form, has been on my website now for more than 20 years. And it gets downloaded and used all over the place. I have no idea who's using it. I really don't care. I mean, it's in the public domain. Sometime in the 1990s, bankers at First Chicago, a bank that no longer even exists, got bought out by J.P. Morgan, started downloading the spreadsheet and using it for their client presentation. They were doing optimal debt ratio. I knew it was happening because I heard from other people. And again, I said, as I said, I don't care. One day I come back from class, the phone rings, and I pick up the phone. It's a First Chicago banker. He says, I'm calling from a restroom. Remember, these were the days before cell phones, so maybe there was a call phone in the restroom. I said, okay. He says, something very embarrassing has happened. I said, you're calling from a restroom? Something very embarrassing has happened? Call your mother. Don't call me, right? This is not my problem. He said, no, not that kind of embarrassing. But I'm in the middle of a client presentation. I've used your Excel spreadsheet, and I've drawn this graph, and there's a kink in the cost to capital graph, something like this. My client wants to know what's going on. What's wrong with your spreadsheet? It takes a lot of gumption to download a spreadsheet for free, use it for a client presentation for which you're charging money, then turn around and call me and say, what's wrong with your spreadsheet? I should have hung up the phone. But I was in a good mood, I told him. In fact, you can probably tell him. I'll give you a clue. There are only two numbers driving my cost of capital, right? There's a cost of equity and a cost of debt. One of those numbers must be moving discontinuously. So what the hell are you talking about? Let's take the cost of equity. As I borrow more money, what do? I estimate a debt-to-equity ratio. I estimate a levered beta. I estimate a cost of equity. So even if my debt ratio changes by a little bit, my beta will change and my cost of equity will change. So the cost of equity is not the culprit. How do I get the cost of debt, though? I come up with an interest coverage ratio. I go to that lookup table. I look to see what rating I would give you based on the interest coverage ratio, and I come up with the cost of debt. You see where I'm going next? Let's say you borrow $10 billion more. But you stay within the same line in the interest coverage ratio. I said, look, your rating is still triple B, therefore your interest rate has not changed. That's really not true. You could be triple B rated and have a higher interest rate, but because I attach one interest rate to it, my cost of debt might not change, even though I have $10 billion more of debt. So this is what's happening. When I go from 60 to 70% debt for Disney, it happens that my interest coverage ratio doesn't change enough to change my rating. So my rating stays fixed, which means my cost of capital drops. But then when I go from 70 to 80, I get this big change because I kind of get the pent-up effect of two different debt ratios changing at the same time. So I said, that's what's happening. He said, can I make it go away? I said, sure. There are two ways you can do it. The first is, I said, that lookup table you have for the ratings, that's just a table I made up. You can break it down into finer parts. What I mean by that is you can do AA++, AA+, AA. So in other words, you break the ratings classes down into finer classes, you're not going to get this problem of staying within the same rating. He said, that sounds like too much work. I said, okay, let me give you a second suggestion. I said, you want a cost of debt, right? This rating is just an intermediate stop. If you can directly connect your interest coverage ratio to your rating, I'm sorry, to the cost of debt, who needs a rating? So what if you had a ratio, that, you know, an equation that said if this is your interest coverage, just like a levered beta equation, if your interest coverage ratio is 7.33, your cost of debt is 5.13%. He said, that sounds too complicated. I said, okay. I said, what's your optimal debt ratio right now? He said, about 30%. I said, where's the kink in your cost of capital graph? He said, about 70%. I said, what if you make it go away? What's going to be your optimal after you make it go away? He said, it's still going to be 30%. I said, why the hell are you wasting your time then making the kink disappear? It's a cosmetic problem, not a real problem. I'm trying to set myself up for, save myself some emails about 4 weeks from now. You know what that 4 weeks from now will be? It's a week before your project is due. I know exactly what's going to happen. You're going to pick a company in that Tuesday or Wednesday. Say, oh my God, he told us to pick a company. You're going to run to the capital structure spreadsheet. You're going to enter the numbers. You're going to get a cost of capital graph, and you're going to get a kink in your cost of capital graph. And you won't go into the restroom to call me. You'll email me saying, what's wrong with your spreadsheet? And I'm going to ask you to go back and watch this class again if you were here, or watch the class for the first time if you were never here, and say the answer is there because that's why there's a kink. And unless your kink happens to be at the optimal, just let it go. It's not changing your answer. Your optimal debt ratio is still 30% or 40% or whatever it is. So now let's complete the process. The optimal debt ratio for Disney is 40% debt. That works out to about $55 billion of debt. Billion. Their existing debt is about $16 billion. So let's pause right there. They have actual debt of $16 billion. I'm telling them they can borrow $55 billion, right? So they have $39 billion in excess debt capacity. So what am I asking them to do? I'm asking them to first borrow $39 billion, but I'm also telling them to do something very specific with that $39 billion, right? What did I say I do with all that debt I get? When we talked about this on Wednesday. When I borrow money in this process, what happens to all that money I borrow? What do I use it for? I use it to either pay dividends or buy back stock. It's called a recapitalization. In other words, I don't take new projects with it. So here I'm asking Disney to borrow $39 billion and buy back stock or pay dividends. It's a huge action. And if they have any sense, with Disney's board, I don't know whether that's even going to be true, but if they have any sense, they should ask me three questions. And these are three generic questions you will always get asked anytime you ask a company to borrow more money, including the company you're analyzing. The first question you're going to ask is, why should we do it? The answer might seem obvious to you. Cost of capital will be lower. You're going to see very quickly why that's not a very good pitch. People are not going to fall for it. I have to convert into real money. Second question you're going to get asked is, what if something goes wrong? You say, what are you talking about? You borrow money? You always have to worry about something going wrong, right? What if something goes wrong? And third, what if you don't want to buy back stock? You're not allowed to buy back stock. What if you have all these great projects lined up? What if I use the debt capacity to take projects instead? Will that still work? Why should we do it? What if something goes wrong? What if I don't want to buy back stock? So let's take each of those questions. Let's start with the first one. If you remember, when I started this cost of capital approach, I said the reason I care about the cost of capital is when I value a company, that becomes my discount rate for my cash flows, the cost of capital. Right now, the cost of capital, before I go to my 55 billion, the existing debt ratio, my cost of capital is 7.81%. So here's what I'm going to do. And for the moment, I'm cheating a little bit because I'm talking about valuing companies, even though that's not for another 8 sessions. But what I'm going to do with Disney as a company is going to resemble what I did for the theme parks and what we did in capital budgeting. I computed the cash flow for the entire company by doing what? By starting with the after-tax operating income, just like I did for the theme park, adding depreciation, subtracting CapEx, subtracting change in working capital. Does that sound familiar? That's how we always go from earnings to cash flows. The cash flow that I got for Disney as a company was $3.66 billion. So that's the cash flow they had. The value for Disney as a company is $133.9 billion. So I take the market value of equity plus debt and you net out the cash. That's what the market says Disney's worth as a company. So I know what the cash flow is. I know what the value of the company is. I know what the existing cost of capital is. I'm going to make a simplifying assumption. I'm going to assume that Disney is a stable company, mature company. What does that even mean? That it's going to grow at a constant rate forever. If you remember, the equation for a constant growth perpetuity is the cash flow next year, 36.57 grown out 1 year, divided by the cost of capital minus the growth rate. So I have the value of the company, I have the cash flow, I have the growth rate. I have the cost of capital. I solve for the growth rate. It's called an imputed growth rate. I'm backing it out of the current value. Why am I doing this? Because I want to focus on capital structure. I don't want to even ask the question, is Disney correctly valued? I'm saying, if Disney is correctly valued, what growth rate is the market building in? And the answer I got was 4.94%. I have to tell you, that's a very dangerous growth rate to use as a perpetual growth rate for a simple reason. The risk-free rate I have in this process at the time that I did this valuation was 2.75%. You're saying, so what? Remember I told you that the risk-free rate is in fact a rough proxy for the growth rate in the economy? So if the growth rate in the economy is 2.75%, assuming that Disney can grow at 4.94% a year is asking for trouble. But let's assume I'm willing to ask for trouble. I'm going to keep that growth rate Let's see what would happen to the value of Disney as a company if all I did was replace the 7.81% cost of capital with a 7.16% cost of capital. The 7.16% cost of capital is the cost of capital at a 40% debt ratio. It's their optimal debt ratio. So think about this. All I've done is taken Disney as a company, kept everything fixed except their debt ratio, and by changing the debt ratio, lowered the cost of capital. The value that I get for Disney as a company is $172.9 billion. It's almost magic. I've increased the value of the company by $39 billion by just changing the mix of debt and equity. Now do you see why this is a much more effective hook than talking about the cost of capital? Because if I told you I want you to borrow $39 billion, and if you do that, your cost of capital will drop by 0.65%. You're going to say, you want me to do what to get what? It doesn't sound proportional. But if I ask you to borrow $39 billion, because by doing that, you will increase your value as a firm by $39 billion, that's really a lot of money. I'll make a confession, though. I think I've overestimated the change in value because I've used that 4.84% growth rate. So I'm going to give you a second way to compute the change in value. And this is a better way, in my view, a more robust way of computing why you should go to the optimal. One way to think about the cost of capital is right now, this is what it's costing you to finance the entire company. So right now, they're financing their entire company, which is worth $133.9 billion, at a 7.81% cost of capital. So that's pre-recapitalization. Their annual cost of financing the company is $10.458 billion. So that's what it's costing them to finance a company with the existing debt ratio. If they go to the optimal, the cost of capital drops to 7.16%. Their annual cost drops to $9.59 billion. Each year, they're going to save $866 million because they moved to a better capital structure. That's each year. The value of a company should increase by the present value of those savings over time. And if I assume now that you have perpetual growth but use a 2.75% growth rate, which is a more reasonable growth rate, the increase in value that I get for Disney as a company is $19.6 billion. This is financial alchemy. You know what alchemy is, right? For hundreds of years, what did alchemists think they could do? Change pretty much everything into gold. Rocks into gold, steel into gold. You give them something, it'll get turned into gold. But this is actually, because the reason I call it financial alchemy is Disney's projects are not changing. Their business is not changing. Their operating income is not changing. So how the heck is their value increasing? So where's this value increase coming from? They're not taking better projects. They're not building bigger theme parks. They're not building more theme parks. Where is the increase in value coming from? Yeah. Well, in this case, I've actually moved to the 2.75, but the 2.75 is basically a growth rate I can see. If I'd used the 4.94%, you'd be right. That could be the issue. But here I've switched back to a 2.75% growth rate, which is in fact a sustainable growth rate forever. I could even make it zero, and I'd still get an increase in value of about $15 billion. So growth rate might be contributing, but it's not the driver. Tell me why. That's the mechanics. But what's causing the discount rate to be lower? Again, we're talking, so your cost of capital is low. What's causing my cost of capital to be lower? Again, we're getting closer, okay? You might not realize it, you're getting closer. How am I recapitalizing? I'm borrowing money. So what is it about the act of borrowing money and replacing equity that's lowering my cost of capital? It's not that, right? Because we said that can't make your cost of capital go down. Back there, so you had a quiver. What do you think it is? No, because it's the same projects. My risk actually doesn't change. In fact, I make my risk go up by borrowing money, not go down. We go back there. See, again, that's not it, right? Because we talked about this. Replacing equity with debt and telling me it's cheaper is, you're just moving things around, right? It's not, Roy? You're reducing your taxes. And you were going to say the same thing, so I'll act like you said the same thing too, right? So you're going to reduce your taxes. Why? Because the government wrote the tax code in a stupid way. The 19.6 billion is come, it's not a value increase, if you think about it. It's really a value transfer. See what I mean by value transfer? Where is Disney getting the 19.6 billion in value coming from? It's coming from the taxpayers. Again, it's not Disney's fault. I'm not saying it's an unethical. They're doing exactly what they should be doing given the tax code. But the next time you hear an LBO guy get up and talk about how much value is created, at the risk of getting thrown out of the room, walk up to the guy, slap him around the face 3 times and say, you haven't created a dollar in value in 25 years. What the hell are you talking about? You've transferred a lot of value from taxpayers to your companies. But leverage cannot create value. If you are writing a paper about the travails of the U.S. economy, this could be one of those issues, right? Because in the last 30 years, an increasing amount of value creation in the U.S. has come from what? What they call financial engineering, leverage transactions. That's not creating value. If you want the economy to grow, you need more projects, you need better theme parks, you need to make more movies. And again, it's not the fault of the people who take advantage of the tax benefits. It's the fact that we've written a tax code that creates this tax subsidy. So let's be very clear about where the value is coming from. And having said that, if I'm a Disney stockholder, guess what? I want them to maximize this value created because I know I'm a taxpayer too. But I get a lot more as a Disney stockholder than I give up as a taxpayer. But you can see the basis for the value creation. Any questions? Yes. Somebody answer the question. Do you know there are any countries where there's no tax benefit for debt? There are two groups of countries where there's no tax benefit for debt. Bermuda, for instance, there's no tax benefit for debt. Why? Because you have no taxes. So that's the easy case. The other is? Much of the Middle East, you will not be allowed to get a tax benefit for debt. But you probably couldn't raise equity either. So you're kind of screwed. Because in a sense, your capital sources, you know, your tax benefit. So I think the Middle East, there's no tax benefit to debt, but nobody takes big projects based on cost of capital anyway because it's so heavily subsidized. But that's the only part of the world where the tax benefits of debt are non-existent. And the reason for that is more religious than financial, right? Simple. Either give a tax benefit to equity or take the tax benefit of debt away. It's easier. I mean, I know what needs to be done. Will it happen? Not in my lifetime. Do you think any politician who gets up and says, you will not get a tax benefit for your interest on your home mortgage, do you think there's any chance you will get elected? Even the people who talk about fixing the tax code, there's always one exception. We will remove all deductions except when you borrow money to buy your house. Too many. See, here's the problem. If you did remove the tax benefits from debt tomorrow, you'd create huge problems because the entire fixed income market is going to implode. Those of you who have jobs in corporate bonds, there'll be no job. Right? So this is not something you can do quick, you know, overnight. It's got to be something that's got to be gradual. And so we know what needs to be done, but we also know that getting it done is going to be really, really difficult because once you create a system, you create an ecosystem that feeds off it, right? And we have created an ecosystem that's built off the tax benefits for debt. Yes?
So why wouldn't someone get elected by getting up and saying, I'll give you a tax benefit?
They do try, right? And in fact, that's the way you give a tax benefit to equity, part of it is you reduce the tax rate on dividends. So the Bush 2003 plan would actually reduce the... Because that's the other way you can bring the tax benefit dividends. Rather than make it tax deductible, make it tax free. So there are countries where dividends have become tax free precisely for that reason. That's the closest you can get. It doesn't completely eliminate because the reason it's not complete is because it provides a tax benefit to the investor rather than the company. So it creates some, you know... But that's the way it's shown up, is by reducing taxes on dividends. Yep.
I'm trying to understand your argument that it's just a transfer of wealth. Mm-hmm. Does it assume that the dollars in the hands of the government are worth the exact same thing?
That's a different. We can debate whether it's better to have the 19.6 billion in Disney's stockholders' hands than in the government's hands, right? No, no, that's not true, though, because if you have a $19.6 billion hole as a deficit, it's not like the government runs things more efficiently to make up the deficit. What does it do? It raises taxes, right? So we still have the same inefficient government with or without the transfer. It's not like if the government were forced to cut costs to make up the difference, then this can become a debate of, are we just making the government more efficient? And maybe this is a better way to, is to just extract revenues. But the government doesn't become more efficient. So we get the worst of both worlds. We get a transfer of wealth from the government. The government stays inefficient, taxes you and me more to make up for it. And we end up with, in a sense, a dysfunctional system. Okay. There are better ways to reduce taxes, right? If you want less money in the hands of government, you don't want it to take the form of tax. But wouldn't it be better if the corporate tax rates were just lowered to 20%? Rather than, what we have right now is if you're a corporation with a lot of debt, as opposed to a corporation with very little debt, our tax system right now is tilted towards the companies with more debt. So maybe what we should say is maybe we shouldn't, no. So that would be my response is, you want less money in the hands of government because you think it's less efficient? There are better tax systems that I can create to deliver that end result.
But then the person that said they did create value
is incorrect. Only if that $20.6 billion goes to you and you somehow magically created value with it. But they're not creating value. What they're saying is I pay the $20.6 billion out. You get the higher value as a Disney stockholder. You go somewhere else and you create value with it. That's a very indirect way of creating value, right? I mean, it's not them creating value. It's they're saying, look, you know, the higher stock price, investors will sell the stock at the higher price, go create value elsewhere. If that's your claim for value creation, it's a very long-winded claim. It's not you creating value. It's the fact that your stockholders can now spend the money elsewhere and create value. So I don't think that argument holds up. I think if you have a leverage-driven transaction, you increase your stockholder wealth. Good for you. That's your job. But don't go around claiming that the economy overall is more productive because you did it. Because that part of the argument is going to be very difficult to sustain. Now let's complete the story, right? So you need to borrow $39 billion plus and buy back shares. How the hell do you do this? How does a company buy back almost $40 billion worth of its own shares? What does it have to do? Companies can buy back shares in one of two ways. One is called an open market operation, which is you go into the market, you buy a few shares today, a few shares tomorrow, 1,000 shares. No. And if you have a small buyback, you can get away with doing that. You can do open market operations. If you're doing a buyback of this magnitude, $39 billion, the only way to do it is doing a tender offer. You know how a tender offer works? Usually you see them in acquisitions, where company A will offer to buy the shares of company B. You take a full page ad in the Wall Street Journal saying, I'll buy your shares. So here's what Disney will have to do. They'll have to take a full page ad in the Wall Street Journal saying, if you're a Disney shareholder, tender your shares back to us and we will pay you X dollars. There's got to be a tender offer price. So you're going to be my investment banker for the next 5 minutes and I'm going to ask you for some advice on how to structure this tender offer. The price before I did this recapitalization was $67.71. So that's the old price. Can I make a tender offer at the old price? I could, but then nobody will tender, right? They say, why would I sell to you? I can sell in the market. So almost by definition, if I'm going to make a tender offer, I've got to offer more than $67.71. How much more? They say, who knows? $3, try $5, try $7. And that's what most investment bankers do. They have no idea. They sit there and they say, oh, let's try this. Oh, 7 looks good. 9 looks good. Okay. It's kind of silly because if you think about it, when you use cash to buy back shares, you're using the cash of the remaining shareholders. Right? So let's divide the company up into two halves. You guys, this entire part of the class, are going to be people who are going to continue to hold your shares after the tender offer. This group is going to tender your shares back to me when I'm... So when I make the tender offer price, you're going to collect the cash, you're going to get rid of your shares, I'm going to burn the shares, and what's left are the remaining shares in the company. What is the total value increase that we came up with? $19.6 billion, right? If this is a fair game, you know what I mean by a fair game? If everybody in this room is going to feel good about this. I want everybody to get an equal share of that $19.6 billion. You're saying, who do you mean by everybody? The people who sell back and the people who don't sell back. If this is fair, everybody should get an equal share of that $19.6 billion. So here's my first try at a fair price. I took the entire $19.6 billion, total value created, divided by the $1.8 billion in total shares outstanding. I know there'll be fewer shares after the buyback, but I'm going to divide by the total number of shares. I get an increase in value of about $10.90. I add that on to the $67.71, and that is a fair price. Because if I pay $78.61, here's what's going to happen. You guys are going to get $78.61 in cash, and you're going to go away. You are going to be left with the remaining shares, and guess what your share price is going to bounce to? It's going to go to $78.61. You're going to be indifferent between selling and staying in the company. That's my measure of, is this buyback a fair buyback? Did you pay the right price? How many buybacks do you think happen at a fair price? Almost none. And if you're going to see a mistake, and remember, there are two kinds of mistakes I can make. One is I can buy at too low a price, in which case, who's hurt and who's helped? Let's say I was able to buy the shares back at the old price. Why? Because people are not even reading the news story. They're just selling shares. If I were able to buy the shares at $67.71, these guys end up with none of the increase in firm value, right? Because they sold at the old price. You now have the remaining shares. You're going to get the entire increase in value. You're going to get a lot more than $78.71. So one mistake I might make is I buy back at too low a price. The other mistake I could make is I buy back at too high a price. Let's say I pay $85 per share. You guys happy? Yeah, of course. You collected $85. What about you guys? Well, I took a big chunk of that $19.6 billion. I've given it away. And how have I rewarded you, my loyal, long-standing stockholders? With a lower price. You tell me what price you do the buyback at. I'll tell you who's being helped and hurt by the buyback. Which mistake do you think is more common, that buybacks happen at too low a price or too high a price? And tell me why that is. It's not just the fee. What makes life for a banker easier? You got to get the deal done, right? You got to get the buyback done. Why would you want to set a low price and struggle with it when you can set an $85 price and it's going to fly out of the window? You don't even have to work. You collect the fee for doing nothing. It's like pricing one of those IPOs at 20% below the value. Any doofus can do this. But most doofuses don't collect 15% of the issuance proceeds for doing something this stupid. So that's, I think, the basis for thinking about buybacks. Let me actually give you a structure for thinking through how this buyback will play out in the price. If you want to figure out how a buyback is going to affect you as the remaining shareholders in the company, here's what you want to start with. Start with how much you're borrowing, because that's what you're going to use for the buyback. Divide by the price at which you can think you can do the buyback. 72, 75, 76, 78, 85, whatever that is. That's going to tell you how many shares you buy back, right? Why do I care? Because the remaining shares will be the shares before minus the shares I bought back. Then here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to compute the equity value after the buyback by taking the optimal value of the company that I computed with the new cost of capital and subtracting out the debt and adding back the cash. And then I'm going to divide that by the remaining shares. Let me try two different prices so you can see exactly what I'm talking about. Let's start with that extreme scenario where I was able to buy the shares back at $67.71. Remember the old price? It's completely unrealistic. But let's assume I could buy shares back at $67.71. I'm borrowing $39,175. 39,175 divided by 67,71 tells me how many shares I buy back because I bought it back at the old price. I remove those shares from circulation. I'm left with 1.221 billion shares in the company. So after the buyback, 1.221 billion. The value of equity in the company is the 153,531 that I estimated is the total value. And if you're wondering where that comes from, right, it's right there, 153,531. Add cash, subtract our debt. I get a value of equity of 102.3 billion. I divide that by the 1.221 billion shares. The value per share that I get for you is $83.78. What was it with the fair price? It was $78.71, right? By being able to buy the shares back at the old price, I've increased the share price of the remaining shareholders because you now get all of the spoils. In fact, just to show you that 78.71 is a fair price. If I'd actually, I'm sorry, 78.61 is a fair price. If I'd actually bought back at the 78.61, the number of shares outstanding after the buyback would have been 1,301, and the price after the buyback would have been 78.61. That's why it's a fair price. So I have a to-do for today's class. What I'd like you to do is tell me what the share price of the remaining shares would be if the stock buyback happened at $84 per share. So use the same framework I used. Figure out what the remaining shares would be trading at if I bought the shares back at $84 per share. I'll email you the answer tomorrow, but I want to give you a chance to try it out on your own, because this is the crux of thinking about buybacks and how they affect different groups in the company. Any questions? Yes. Right. No. I chose it because it maximized the value of the company, right?
So then after that, now you've decided to buy back.
No, I didn't decide now. Because how did I come up with the original optimal debt ratio? Remember, all this process was built on the assumption that I was going to buy back the share. So it's not after the fact that I changed my mind. This is how I built the entire structure of the recapitalization, is on the assumption of buying back shares. Now let's talk about the second question. What if something goes wrong? You know the one answer you should never give if somebody asks you, what if something goes wrong? Nothing will go wrong. Because it's almost like tempting fate. It's like the gods are waiting for you to say it, bang on your head. So if anybody asks you, what if something goes wrong, here's what I'd suggest you do. Ask them what they're worried about. What is it that can go wrong? Because the answer is going to be different depending on the company. If you're a defense contractor, what are you worried about? That your contract might be cut by the Defense Department. If you're a manufacturer that gets 40% of your sales from Walmart, what are you worried about? That Walmart will cancel your contract. If you're a cyclical company, and you say, what can go wrong? You're worried about a recession. And if you're a commodity company or an oil company, you're worried about oil prices going to $25 a barrel. What I'm trying to say is what managers worry about varies across companies. And it's your job and my job not to say, hey, don't worry about it, but to think about how that affects your optimum. And there are two ways you can approach asking that question. One is you can take the operating income of the company, which is a central number driving much of the optimum, and say, what if that operating income were 10% lower, 20% lower, 30% lower? Obviously, the optimum will change. You want to see by how much. And I'll take you through the process of why 10 as opposed to 30. So first is to play what-if questions with the operating income. The second is to take the very specific thing that people are worried about, that Walmart will cancel the contract, work out what it will do to the operating income, and see what will my optimal be if that happens. And the other is, in my original capital structure analysis, and I said go to the point at which your cost of capital is minimized, I never mentioned what your rating was at that level. It could be BB for all you know. And most companies will not accept a BB rating. We'll see why. You could put a constraint on your rating. So let's start with the first one. To see what a bad year looked like for Disney. It sounds like a stupid question. What's a bad year look like? Of course, your operating income is going to be lower. It varies across companies, right? If you look at a regulated utility, a bad year might be a 5% drop in operating income. For a technology company, it might be a 50% drop. For Disney, I looked at the last 25, 30 years of data. And across those years, from 1987 through 2013, the worst year that Disney's ever had was a drop in operating income of 29.5% in 2000. That's a really bad year for Disney, a 29.5% drop. I also looked at the statistical number. What's the standard deviation that changed? It's about 19%. But I finally looked at what happened during the last four recessions. 81 through 82, they actually increased their operating income. In 91, their operating income dropped by 22%. In 2002, it dropped by 16%. In 2009, it dropped by 23%. What I'm trying to get out of all this number crunching is to gauge what a bad year for Disney looks like. So a bad year for Disney is probably, what, a 20, 25% drop in operating income? So here's what I did next. I took my base operating income of 10,032, went back to the spreadsheet and dropped it by 10, 20, 30 to see how much my optimal would change if I had lower operating income. So my optimal at my existing operating income is 40%. If I lower the operating income by 10%, it stays at 40%. I lower it by 20%, it stays at 40%. You see, so what does that tell me? It tells me that Disney has enough buffer in its operating income that it could have a bad year and still be okay with a 40% optimum. That's not always going to be the case. So I'm going to jump ahead. 4 weeks from now, you do the optimal debt ratio for your company. You come up with 40%. But your company is a very volatile company. So you drop the operating income by 10%, and your optimal goes from 40 to 20%. What should you do? Do the prudent thing. Don't go to 40%. You have too little buffer. That's the kind of company where you say, look, I have debt capacity, but rather than go all the way to 40, I'm going to stop at 20 because there isn't enough buffer built into this process. This isn't a mechanical process. If it were, I don't need you, right? I can just set this up so the data feeds into a spreadsheet, the optimal jumps out, the optimal goes to the CFO picks the optimal, we all move on. There is that process of you thinking about your company and bringing it to your decision process. So that's the first way to ask the what if question, is to play with the operating income. Here's the second. Almost every company I worked with has had some rating below which they don't want to drop. For US companies, you know what the most common constraint is for ratings? What rating do they not want to drop below? So what is it? A, it's close, but it's actually the term used as investment grade. What is investment grade? What's the rating that goes with an investment grade? It's actually BBB. So you don't want to drop below BBB, that's investment grade. Why is that? Why do you don't, you know, what's so bad about dropping from BBB to BB plus, dropping below investment grade? Yeah. So you're labeled a junk bond, so who cares? Sounds bad, but sounds don't carry costs. Okay. But in fact, there is a story you can tell, right? So you go from BBB to BB plus. The Wall Street Journal runs a story about you becoming below investment grade, a junk bond company. Who else is reading that story? Your customers, your employees, your suppliers. It's not that it sounds bad, but that bad sound then creates, you know, revenue drops and higher costs and bigger. So that's the indirect bankruptcy cost. So that's the first reason. You know what the other reason used to be, Troy? It's that you could not go to capital markets if you were below investment grade. Before 1981, if you were below investment grade, you couldn't go issue bonds. You say, but they were junk bonds before 81. The way they got junk is they started investment grade and they slid. 1981, though, that changed fairly significantly. And I'll give you a clue. It's a guy called Mike Milken at a company called Drexel Burnham. What did they create? Mortgage-backed securities was Lou Ranieri at Solomon. So Drexel actually was... They actually created an original issue junk bond market. That's what the innovation was. You're saying, what the hell does it even mean? They said, you can be BB rated and actually go to the market. We will find investors who will buy those bonds. And what that actually meant was the cost of dropping below investment grade got smaller. It didn't disappear, but it got smaller post-81. But there's still a cost. So most companies will say, we don't want to drop below BBB. Or they could add a little buffer and say, we don't want to drop below single A. Once in a while, though, you will run into a CEO or a CFO who gives you a rating constraint that makes no sense. I'll give you an example. A conversation I had with the CFO of, or the CEO of one of the last AAA-rated European steel, it was a European steel company, one of the last AAA-rated steel companies in the world. It was in the early 90s. And the company was run with this fixation, we have to be AAA-rated. Everything they did revolved around the AAA rating. So I remember asking the guy, what's this fixation you have with this AAA rating? And he said, that's easy. We can borrow money at a really low rate. I said, okay. How do you maintain your AAA rating? You know what he told me? We never borrow money. This is the kind of circular logic that gets you into trouble. So you really want a AAA rating because it lets you borrow money at a really low rate, but the only way you can maintain it is by never borrowing money. Who the hell cares? Why don't you settle for a AA rating and actually borrow some money, right? It actually makes sense. So here's what I'm going to suggest you do. If you're given a rating constraint by a company, rise to the challenge and give them the bill. You're saying, what do you mean? know whether you ever took an operations research class somewhere along the way. But any time you have an optimization problem, don't worry, I'm not going to take you into an operations research class. You have an optimization problem, you can solve the problem. Then I put a constraint on the optimization problem. You do that, right? Mathematically, you add a constraint. A constrained optimal can never be better than an unconstrained optimal. It's mathematically impossible, right? That's why socially responsible investing can never deliver a higher return than investing without that constraint. You're saying, that's so immoral. That's fine. You can have a morality issue with it, but you can't add a constraint to a process and say, the process is now better. So here's what I do. Let's take Disney. Right? The optimal that I got was 40%. The rating that I got for them at a 40% debt ratio was single A, which actually is not a bad rating, and they probably will take it. But let's say that Disney CFO comes back to me and says, no, single A doesn't work for me. I want at least a double A rating. Here's what I have to do. I have to go to the spreadsheet, and I can't go all the way to 40% because my rating drops to single A. I had to drop at 30%. So I took the value of the company at 40%, the unconstrained optimal. I took it at 30%, which is the constrained optimal. The difference of $5.7 billion is the cost of having a double A rating constraint. He says, let's say he said, I want a AAA rating constraint. Not a problem. AAA rating constraint, the most you can borrow is 20%. The value that you have at 20% is $141 billion. The cost of having a AAA rating constraint is $12.1 billion. You say, what does that mean? The CEO really wants a AAA constraint? Here's what I'm going to suggest you do. He should get in front of stockholders and say, look, we want a AAA constraint. We want a rating, and this is what it's going to cost you as stockholders, $12.1 billion. Are you okay with that? Let's see if they vote on that. You want bragging rights to be a AAA-rated company CEO? That's fine. But if it's costing your stockholders $12 billion to get there, I don't know whether it's worth those bragging rights. So what if something goes wrong? Not a big deal. Either bring in the operating income effect or the rating constraint, and you can answer that question. Third question, what if instead of borrowing money and buying back stock, we wanted to borrow money and take projects? Would my optimal be different? I'll give you this short answer first. No, if you're going to stay in the same business mix. What does that mean? If Disney is going to borrow money to build more theme parks, make more movies, more Star Wars movies, more TV shows, expand ESPN, I'm okay with that because the optimal will expand with the company because as the company gets larger, the cash flows will get larger. But if Disney says, we'd like to borrow money and buy Twitter, what do you think is going to happen to the optimal if they decided they're going to buy Twitter? First, Twitter a risky company or a safe company? It's so bad, it's safely bad. But it's a risky company because of all kinds of bad things. Is it a positive cash flow company or a negative cash flow company? It's a negative cash flow. It's a money-losing company that has to reinvest a lot. So you buy a risky, negative cash flow company, what do you think is going to happen to your debt capacity? You can't borrow as much. So if you're Disney and you say, look, I want to borrow money to buy Twitter, I'm going to have to say, look, I have to go back and redo your optimal with what you're buying, and maybe your optimal will drop to 30 or 25% because you're buying a risky, money-losing company. Never give managers blank checks. Don't tell them you have $30 billion debt capacity, do whatever you want, because they will. You have to be careful about what they're investing in. So now let me apply this process to the other companies in my analysis. I'm not going to take you through the level of detail because I don't want to torture you. But with each of these companies, I'm going to focus on something very specific. So I did exactly what I did with Disney with my capital structure spreadsheet, came up with the cost of capital at different debt ratios. So let me start with Tata Motors. The optimal debt ratio for Tata Motors is about, so where is that? Right there, 20% debt. So look at the second last column. 20% debt ratio. That's where the cost of capital is minimized. Disney, Tata Motors actual debt ratio was about 29%. So that's too much debt. So let's say if this were a standalone company, you'd probably say, you should pay down the debt. You have too much debt, right? But let me fill in the story. I did this actually not just for Tata Motors, but for three other Tata companies, Tata Steel, Tata Chemicals, and Tata Consulting Services, all publicly traded companies under the same family group. And here's what I found. I found that Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Chemicals had too much debt. Just like that, you know, they had too much debt. But Tata Consulting Services, which could afford to borrow a significant amount, borrowed no money at all. Saying, what does that even mean? I'll give you my cynical side of what's happening here. Tata Motors goes to a bank in Mumbai and tries to borrow money. The banker is probably going to look at their finances and say, you're already pretty tightly stretched. You shouldn't be borrowing money. And if this were a standalone independent company, they'd probably be running into a constraint. But you see what the Mumbai bank is going to be looking at? They're going to say, oh, you're Tata Motors, okay. You're part of the Tata family group, right? I know this is a very dangerous thing to do, but what's the banker falling back on? He's saying, if you get into trouble, the family group is going to step in and cover the difference. There's no legal backing, but with family group companies, this is often a common occurrence, where one company's debt capacity is being used by another company in the same group to borrow money. You know who should be really pissed off about this? Who's being hurt by this? Tata, not all the other companies. It's Tata Consulting Services stockholders, because you're using my debt capacity not to give me a tax benefit, but to give the Tata Motors guy a tax benefit. How is that fair? So what can I do about it? Absolutely nothing. Corporate governance. I don't know what the cost is, but in a sense, that's what the banker is assuming, that there'll be a backup from the family group. In fact, in Dubai, this became a factor about the Dubai ports. I don't know whether anybody remembers. But the United Arab Emirates is the cash cow. I'm sorry, Abu Dhabi is the cash cow for the United Arab Emirates. So when Dubai does all these big projects, guess who the implicit backer for these projects is? It's Abu Dhabi. The banker said, if I lend to Dubai, well, Abu Dhabi will step in. Until Dubai ports got into trouble and the banker said, I'm going to go to Abu Dhabi. And Abu Dhabi said, no, I don't see anything in the contract. And that's part of why it became part of the process now that, now if you're in Dubai, in fact, a great deal of the power in Dubai had to be turned over to Abu Dhabi after that collapse because of that reason. But people lend on implicit backing all the time. I mean, it's going probably in the Middle Ages, in Venetia, the son of a rich Venetian glassmaker. Idle layabout, you don't have a job. You go to borrow money, the money lender lends you money, right? Why? Because they think your father's going to step in and pay your loan. That's essentially what's happening. The family group is viewed as a backup. There's no legal backing for it. But as long as it happens enough, you shouldn't be surprised to see it happening. And I took Vale. I did the optimal debt ratio for Vale, and I found it to be significantly over levered. Its optimal debt ratio was 30%. Its actual debt ratio was 39%. But you know why it had become over-levered? It was actually not over-levered a year before. It didn't borrow any extra money, but iron ore prices had dropped. And when iron ore prices dropped and operating income dropped, the optimal debt ratio decreased. And to show you how dangerous commodity companies' leverage can be, in 2013, if I try to normalize iron ore prices, things are going to bounce back. By using the previous 10 years, 2004 through 2013, my optimal debt ratio would have gone back up to 50%. But here's the catch. The average iron ore price between 2004 and 2013 was $80 a ton. The average iron ore price over the previous century was about $25 to $30 a ton. So what happened between 2004 and 2013 that made iron ore prices go up so much? Come on, I've given you this answer. Anytime you're in trouble, what did I say you should say? China. It is. China, and the reason is very simple. All you have to do is, if you've gone to Shanghai or Beijing and you look at those big infrastructure investments, where do you think all that steel came from? Single-handedly, China pushed up the prices of commodities for that decade. And here's the problem. In 2013, if you assume that they would revert back to the average, Vale looked like it was okay. But you know what's happened since 2013? Iron ore prices have continued to drop. And today, the optimal debt ratio for Vale is 10%. Its actual debt ratio is 60%. What was a little chasm now has become a huge gap. And we're going to come back and talk about what to do about it. Obviously, Vale today is hopelessly overlevered. Third company I looked at was Baidu. The optimal debt ratio for Baidu is about 10% debt. Why is it so low? Because it's a growth company. You're saying, why should that matter? If you're a growth company, your market value is going to be high, reflecting your growth potential, right? But you don't have the cash flows because those projects haven't been taken. So don't be surprised if you do the optimal debt ratio of your company and you're looking at Pandora or Fitbit as your company to come up with an optimal debt ratio of close to 0%. Because you get to 10% for these companies, you're already tipping over the company into potentially default. So 10% doesn't sound like much until you think about the fact, I have no earnings, no cash flows, very low earnings. Your optimal debt ratios will end up as a low number. And here's the final company. I looked at Bookscape, passed it through the same process. And the one catch here was it's a private company. I don't have a market value of equity to get started, so I cheated. I took the net income for the company, which is 1.575 million. I took a PE ratio, price earnings ratio of other book companies, which is 20, and I estimated a market value. Why? Because I need to get started. My optimal debt ratio with that market value of equity was 30% debt. Their actual debt ratio was about 28%. So I have one underlevered company, Disney. I have two overlevered companies in Tata Motors and Vale. Baidu and Bookscape are pretty close to where I'd expect them to be. But you can already see the variations across those companies. So when I send you the spreadsheet, try to put the numbers in for your company. See what you get as an optimal. It'll take all of 15 minutes to do. Okay? And it'll come with so read the entire email. I know you read the first line. It's another email from this guy. I'm not reading it. This one I want you to read till the very last paragraph because I'm going to talk about the little red hen. You read the book of the little red hen? I'll give you the link to the book as well. It's a children's book. And you're going to see why you should read to the little red hen ending paragraph. So let's kind of gather together. So the cost of capital approach is a very convenient approach. I've used it for a long time. But I also know its limitations. There are three limitations. One is it's static. You know what I mean by static? I take last year's operating income. I take interest rates today, risk premiums today. And those could all change. Second, if you think about what I did to the operating income for Disney, as I went from 0% debt to 90% debt, I left it at $10,032 million, even though my rating went from AAA down to C. So I was ignoring the indirect bankruptcy costs that come from having a lower rating. And the third problem here is, if you think about how I computed the beta and the cost of equity and the cost of debt, I used the beta and the rating. So to the extent that that process is screwed up, my cost of capital could be screwed up. So I'm going to try to do something at least about the second problem. Here's what I'm going to do to bring in what I think is a more realistic cost of capital. Instead of leaving the operating income at what it is all the way through, I'm actually going to make it a function of what your bond rating is. Let me explain. I'm going to give you an operating income at AAA, but as you go from AAA to AA to single A to BBB to BB to B, I'm actually going to start to lower your operating income as you get to lower ratings because people stop buying your products. Suppliers will start demanding cash. Employees might become more expensive to keep. So that's I'm going to bring in distress costs. And if I want to make this analysis dynamic rather than static, I can make it do that, right? Remember the Monte Carlo simulations we did where instead of having one operating income, you put in a distribution? I could do that here. So here's what I did for Disney. As long as the rating was A minus or above, I said Disney's not going to be affected. Nobody's going to stop going to theme parks, not watch a Star Wars movie, not watch ESPN because the company is A minus rated rather than single A. But as the rating dropped from A minus to triple B to double B to single B, I started lowering the EBITDA for the company, the operating income for the company. You see, how do you come up with the 5% and the 10, the 15? I'll be honest with you, I made up the numbers with a little help. And here's the help I used. I actually looked at companies that had been downgraded over the last 15 years, and I looked at what happened to their operating income in the next year. It's a lot of noise in the process, but that's my way of saying, hey, if your rating drops, this is what could happen to your operating income. So here's what's going to happen. As I change my debt ratio now, I'm going to compute the interest coverage ratio, and I come up with the cost of debt and the cost of capital. But in addition, I'm also going to check my rating. And if my rating starts dropping, I also have to adjust my operating income. So both things are changing. It's not just the discount rate, but the numerator as well, which means that I can no longer just minimize my cost of capital. I've got to look at the numerator as well. So in this page, you actually see my last column. Don't focus on the second to last column because that just gives you where the cost of capital is minimized. I want to go to the point where the value of the firm is maximized. The last column, that happens at 40%. But look at what happens between 40 and 50%. My value goes from 172 billion to almost 36 billion. That's like you fall off the cliff. That's absurd, a 10% debt ratio. Valiant's value a year ago was 100 billion. 100 billion. You know what the value is right now? It's less than 10 billion. That's what happens when you fall off the cliff. That's why I say stay away from the cliff, right? I mean, you want to kind of avoid that. So in this case, if you're going to make a mistake, make it at 35 rather than 45. Because at 35, you give up some cost of capital, but it's not the kind of mistake that's going to cost to your company. So the enhanced cost of capital approach, the only difference is the rating changes, the operating income changes, so both the numerator and the denominator could change. Yes, Justin. Because once you start the spinning cycle happens, what happens is your rating causes your interest expense to go up, your interest expense goes up. Remember how we did those iterations? The iterations start spinning out of control. And here there's a second factor. As your rating drops, your operating income also drops. Your operating income drops, the coverage ratio gets even lower. It's like watching the process kind of, you know, implode in front of you. Because it's the perception that you're in trouble starts to cause your operations to come apart. It's not one point, right? 10% debt ratio means that there's a certain tipping point for your debt where you look comfortable, but you're one shock away from losing that comfort. We close today by talking about what to do about financial service companies. First, let's set on the table that to talk about the optimal debt ratio for a financial service company is kind of silly. And here's what. Debt to a bank is not a source of capital. It's raw material. You know what I mean by that? How does a bank make money? What does an old-fashioned bank do? It borrows money at? Basically, it makes money off the spread. It borrows at 3%, lends it out at 5%, right? Boring business, but that's banking. So to talk about the optimal debt ratio for a bank makes no sense. But let me ask you a different question. A bank cannot have too much debt, but can it have too little equity? You read about it all the time. This bank, Citibank, has too little equity. And when they say too little equity, what are they measuring it against when a bank has too little equity? Again, what? I wish it were debt because that would make it more like a conventional case. They're measuring it against regulatory capital requirements because regulatory capital is defined as equity. So when Citi is called undercapitalized or Deutsche is called undercapitalized, it's because what they have is equity is too low relative to a regulatory capital requirement. Yes?
I guess the reason why I said it was so equity that is, aren't those requirements imposed?
No, because in a sense, it's actually almost entirely contingent on your book equity. That's why banks can fix the problem by going on and raising book equity. They never pay down debt because it doesn't make sense. You can't even pay down debt as a bank. Your balance sheet will kind of implode. So when banks have too little equity, unlike a regular manufacturing company, we can change either the debt or the equity. With banks, you almost always have to increase equity. So that's why it's almost you have only one piece of your capital structure is a moving piece. The other piece is driven by your operations. You can't unfold that piece. So it's almost always going to be an equity problem. So mathematically, you're right. The debt affects the equity. But the only variable you can control as a bank is the equity part. You can't pay down the debt because it's tied to loans or whatever else you're doing. So it means you have a lot less freedom in how you do things. So let me give you a very simple example of how this is going to work. Right? Let's say you're a bank. You make loans. You have $100 million in loans, and you have $6 million in book equity. So right now, your regulatory capital ratio, let's assume book equity is equal to regulatory capital. It's not a bad assumption. Is 6%. So ready? So right now, you have $100 million loans, 6% regulatory capital ratio. Let's assume next year you expect a lot of growth. You expect your loans to increase by 50% from 100 million to 150 million. But many of these loans are going to be given to riskier credits. So you start to get a little worried. So, well, these people might not pay me back. I want to increase my regulatory capital ratio from 6% to 7%. So you ready? Right now you have 6 million. Next year, you will need 10.5 million equity. Why? Because 7% of 150 million is 10.5 million. You will need to come up with $4.5 million of equity next year. So tell me how the bank is going to come up. What's the most natural way of coming up with additional equity? It's almost organic. Yes? Or even before that, there's an even simpler way. When you're a bank and you make loans and you make profits and you don't pay those retained earnings. So the first stop you're going to make is, and if you can get 4.5 million retained earnings, you're going to get down and you're saying, thank you, God. This is a great bank. But odds are, let's say you can get 2 million in net income and you pay $1 million in dividends. So you have only $1 million in retained earnings. You're $3.5 million still short. What's the first thing you should think about doing then? Because every time you pay a dividend, what happens? You get deeper in the hole. So maybe you can cut back on dividends, but we'll talk about why banks never want to do that. If you don't want to cut back on dividends, you're now $3.5 million still short. You have to go out and issue new equity. This has been the story of banks since 2008. Because since 2008, two things have happened. Their regulatory equity has been hammered. Hammered by what? Every time you hear about, today for instance, Goldman has agreed to pay, what, a $5 billion, I think, fine for some legal entanglement. You know where that $5 billion comes out of? It comes out of your regulatory equity. Remember the J.P. Morgan had that big whale shark, whatever, swordfish problem in London where they lost like $5, $6, $7 billion. That comes out of book equity. Every time you hear of a crisis in a bank, it's coming out of book equity. So one thing that's happening is each of these blows is lowering book equity. The other thing that's happening is the regulatory guys are getting more nervous. They're increasing the regulatory capital requirements. So it's creating a gap, and that gap is a problem for banks, and increasingly banks are having to raise new equity to cover the difference. So let me close with this page. So I tried to do this for Deutsche, where I took their, and this was in 2013 when Deutsche was actually pretty healthy. Things have kind of deteriorated there. But basically what I did each year was I took what's called their risky asset base, that's the total amount of loans, et cetera, that they create. And I looked at what their regulatory capital ratio was. It was about 15.13%. And they had targeted getting to an 18% capital ratio. I estimated how much it'll work out to. And what you see there is how much they will have to come up with as new equity each year. See this bottom line, the negative numbers? Those are new equity issues they will need to make every year for the next 3 years just to get back to steady state. Okay? So we'll continue with this on Wednesday, and I will see you. Be shut down.
What percentage is held by managers usually?
Very small. The money's at the bank, almost nothing, right? JP Morgan turns the managers
are not. So where are they getting this money if they don't have this control?
They have to raise new, issue new shares to the market.
Where are they going to get the control? Because they're getting a control for money, right? For new shares.
Yeah.
So but if, for example, JP Morgan doesn't have a lot of control, then where are they going to get the money? How are they going to issue shares?
What do you mean, what's control got to do with issuing shares? Public companies issue shares. You get a piece of the company. You buy the shares, not for the control, but for dividends or income or whatever else, right? People don't buy shares for control. Publicly traded companies, people buy shares because they want a share of the cash flows, right? Control is like icing on the cake. But if you're buying JP Morgan shares for control, you're going to have no control with or without the shares.
You buy it because you get a piece of the dividend, so you get a piece of the cash flows. Right? Control is never the lead reason why people buy shares.
But then can't we just issue like a lot of shares to get even?
Issue a lot of shares, but then you have more shares, your earnings per share drops off, your stock price is going to suffer. You might not last as managers, right? There's a consequence.
Yeah. As you were talking about the ratings and the rating changes, mm-hmm. I was thinking about the Berkshire Hathaway came up. As a holding company, how do you assign the ratings?
They have different ratings. So if you look at Berkshire Hathaway's ratings, they'll actually have GEICO as its own rating, Berkshire Hathaway as its own rating. So there's actually ratings for the different pieces.
Oh, so you wouldn't classify the rating as one?
Especially because GEICO borrows on its own. Any subsidiary that borrows on its own will have its own rating.
I see. So as the holding company, would it have its own rating as well?
Yeah.
Okay. Fine.
Give it to you.
Yeah. I sent you an email last week.
You won't get a response. You said, I will just check it off, that you missed some quotes.
Oh, is that what I'm doing? Okay. I wasn't too well.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Yep. I just had a quiz question. I was wondering if the -1 came from part B or C. Yeah, I realized at the end, but I didn't have time to check
it. It's from part B. Where's the expensing part? No, but where is it? This is your tax saving from depreciation, right? Mm-hmm. So depreciation was 300. Is it was 300?
Yeah, I realized at the end of it changed it to 200.
Okay, so let's say 300 is right. And so the present value of the tax savings from 300 has to be compared to the tax savings from expenses, right?
Okay.
And so I'll give you a half point because the depreciation. Just send me an email.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
I have a question on the optimal debt ratio. Mm-hmm. I noticed that you kind of just split up into 10% increments. What if it's like 41.2?
Don't get that specific. Because you have enough assumptions to make. You want to give a rough sense of where you want to go. Don't make it more precise.
So like on the project and everything, now it's 10% increments?
Yeah.
All right, awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Why don't you walk up with me because I have to catch a train today.